What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And actually, no, you're not Robert Lamb. You're DJ Radio Tropism.
Oh, yeah. And what's your DJ name today?
Oh, it would clearly be DJ Cryptococcus. We'll get to that later. So today we're going to be talking about radioactivity and radio-friendly organisms. But to start us off, I wanted to take us back to something that happened a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
So we sometimes go on Facebook Live, the live streaming media service, and talk about inane garbage, movie trailers and stuff.
Inane garbage, important B-movie and sometimes non-B-movie trailers, and discuss the ways that they tie into our discussions here on the podcast and the topics that we cover.
Well, there's nothing wrong with inane garbage. That wasn't inherently a pejorative. I mean, I love inane garbage. Right, so we went on Facebook Live, and we were talking about giant crab movies, a film genre that I think is severely underrealized. It has a lot of potential. There's just not enough there. You young aspiring filmmakers out there need to get on the giant crab movie train.
Yeah, it's as easy as buying a real crab or catching one on the beach and filming it.
Right. Put it in close up.
Yeah.
Superimpose some movie. Little people. Yeah, it's amazing. And one of the movies we talked about was Attack of the Crab Monsters. So this was released in 1957, directed by, as I would call him, the Crud Wizard, Roger Corman. And it is a plot you've heard a million times before. Scientists go to an island in the Pacific where there has been atomic testing. And eventually they have to square off against a couple of giant, intelligent, sort of psychic crabs that project their voices into your dreams and stuff. It's odd. It's a script by Charles B. Griffith, who is a regular Corman writer. He's the same guy who wrote Little Shop of Horrors, Not of This Earth, and one of my favorites, It Conquered the World.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Where Earth is attacked by an artichoke with an underbite.
Yeah, and of course you end up with a long, the best part of that movie is you have lengthy scenes in which Lee Van Cleef and Peter Graves discuss the philosophical quandaries related to alien invasion.
What does freedom really mean?
Yeah, so I have a special place in my heart for that film too.
Anyway, in an interview, Griffith the screenwriter of Attack of the Crab Monsters, tells the story about where this screenplay came from. And he says Roger Corman came to him and said, I want to make a picture called Attack of the Giant Crabs. Obviously, the name evolved a little. And then Griffith says, I asked, does it have to be atomic radiation? And Corman responded, yes. And, you know, that's kind of the way it was in the sci-fi and horror of the 1950s. We went through the atomic age. It was we of course had just had a world war that was concluded with the use of atomic weapons. And it was almost like if you're Corman thinking about Griffith coming to you saying, does it have to be atomic radiation again? It's like, why are you even asking? Of course, this movie has to be about atomic radiation, making animals bigger, more powerful, sometimes more intelligent, more rampagey versions of those same animals.
Well, I love what you just said, because that, I mean, that's essentially what atomic power did for the human race, right?
Yeah, once a society acquired it.
Yeah, we became this this thing that was more rampagey, more dangerous. B-movies are always the initial sounding chamber for cultural anxiety. And so you can think of it as Oppenheimer, invoking his famous quote from Hindu scripture and saying, now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. Imagine him speaking that into the amplifier of B-movie culture, and what you get are all of these atomic super creatures and atomic supermen spiraling out into comic book characters, etc., as this anxiety works its way through our fiction.
Now, I know you're sort of joking and sort of serious, and I want to agree with you on both halves, especially the sort of serious part. I totally agree that B-movies are often where we work out our sort of taboo anxieties, mm-hmm. and it's where the conscience of the common person comes through into the arts and entertainment. But another fun fact, I cannot leave this subject without divulging, is that Griffith thinks, he says in the same interview, that in some scenes in the movie, the person operating the giant crab monster prop may have been Jack Nicholson, because he was working on sets there at the time. Uh-huh. Man, that's a great fact.
That's magical to think of, yeah.
Especially look up this crab and think, yeah, it could be Jack under there.
Yeah, we got to give the. How often do you encounter that with someone in a monster suit turns out to be an important acclaimed actor later on?
But then, of course, sometimes the monster itself becomes a character. Now, obviously, there are not a whole franchise of giant crab movies. The giant crab monster is never caught on as a beloved folk hero.
Right.
But some giant radioactive monsters do.
Yeah. The best example of that would be, of course, Gojira, Godzilla, who continues to rampage through our cinematic history here.
Now, is it officially part of the Godzilla canon that Godzilla was created by atomic radiation?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's when you go back to the original Godzilla, that's the idea.
Yeah.
That, and it's really kind of beautiful in its own way, right? I mean, this is where, in the same way that all these other monsters managed to emerge from, you know, largely Western contemplations of the atomic age, Godzilla is a frightening manifestation of the Japanese contemplation of the atomic age. And yeah. And it really shines through in that first film, because that first film is far
campy.
Darker.
Yeah.
It's a dark film. It just becomes campier over time as people grow used to the idea of a giant rampaging lizard creature.
And when the giant rampaging lizard creature becomes the hero rather than the villain.
Yes. You know, I watched part of the Shin Godzilla, the new Godzilla film out of Japan, mm-hmm. on an airplane recently. And I need to sit down and watch it in complete form, because it seems like there are a lot of scenes of experts sitting around tables discussing the political ramifications of combating Godzilla, which I love films like that. They take the monster or whatever the sort of fantastical element and just really get down and start teasing it apart with the real world factors. But of course, more recently, for most American audiences, we had this this new treatment of Godzilla that introduced some additional radioactive elements. The idea that that Godzilla and his fellow massive unidentified terrestrial organisms, or MUTOs, were radiation-dependent organisms, radiation-feeding leftovers from a primal terrestrial era in which there was a lot more radioactivity on the Earth, and organisms had evolved to depend upon it.
Now, that could play into some of the science we actually discuss later in this episode.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind.
Yes. Now, of course, there are plenty of people who would argue that, well, you can't really nail Godzilla down. He's right. You can't throw too much science at Godzilla, even though we can't stop doing it.
He's more like a scaly Zeus.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, there's a wonderful quote that I ran across. This is from film producer Shogo Tomiyama. And it was a 2004 interview with the now defunct pennyblood.com, but you can find archived versions of this. And he said, this is a translation, I believe, "Godzilla is closer to being a god. He's not just a living animal or a monster. The fact is that humans cannot control or judge the gods. They have their own will. They have their own way. In Japan, there are many gods. There is a god of destruction. He totally destroys everything, and then there is a rebirth. Something new and fresh can begin. Godzilla is closer to being that kind of god."
Now, this brings us to the Godzilla-Euthyphro dilemma. Is the righteous because it's loved by Godzilla? Or is it righteous because never mind.
What is love by Godzilla? It is that there's an answer to that, but it changes, I think, from film to film.
It's obviously Rampage.
Yeah, I mean, it's easier to nail down Gamera. What does Gamera love? The children.
Right.
And that's why I think I'm more drawn to Gamera.
Okay, we should look at some other radiation eating organisms that are either powered up by radiation or derive their everyday energy from it.
All right. Well, Christian and I recently did an episode dealing with some of the science of The Expanse. Mm-hmm. And if you're watching that show or if you've read the first book, you know that there's this thing called the protomolecule that shows up, and it's an extrasolar biology reassembling system that enters the picture. And it's shown that ionizing radiation is an energy source to this thing.
Hmm.
So I'll say no more about that without getting into spoilers. But yeah, radiation eating organisms of a sort do play into that series.
Now, I see you have a note about it here. I know the ghouls in Fallout.
Yeah.
In the Fallout series, they get love from the radioactive energy.
Yeah. And also the main character, at least in the main, you know, recent games, the character that you play, the Wanderer, the Vault Walker, or whatever the descriptions are that they throw out for him, you can pick up perks where the radiation heals you and you kind of like feed off the radiation.
So this is a path you can choose to take in the game to say, I want to live on radiation.
Yeah, I want to be able to drink radioactive water. Yeah, which one of the things I love about the recent Fallout games is there'll be these moments where you're standing like ankle deep in maybe not full blown radioactive water, but bad water that you should not drink. Like you're standing in a sewer and you look down and you go, oh, there's an ammo clip down there. I better pick it up. But you accidentally click on the water next to the clip instead of the clip itself. And so you reach down with your hand and you get a big scoop full of the water and you drink it. And
there's
it damages
a sipping
your body.
Sound effect, yeah. I think.
Yeah. Because I love the idea of that happening where it's, oh, crap, I just meant to pick up the clip and I just drank radioactive water instead. Oh, I'm such a doofus. So those are just a few radiation-eating, radiation-absorbing creatures to consider. But fiction is full of many examples of radioactive mutants, and giant mutant animals are a big one. So we've talked about a number of these examples before. You mentioned the crabs already. But it brings up another B-movie icon, the director of really one of my favorite films from this era, The Amazing Colossal Man.
Right. I haven't seen this one still. This is the one where there is a man who gets some kind of radiation and he grows huge. And it, of course, it's directed by Bert I. Gordon, Mr. Big himself.
Yeah, B-I-G. Yeah.
Who mostly made movies about things getting big, about big spiders, big dinosaurs. There's one movie of his that made a great Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode called The Beginning of the End, where it explores the sort of downstream food ecosystem effects of radiation gigantism, where this scientist makes some giant vegetables, but I may be remembering this wrong, but I think he injects them with radiation with a needle. I apologize if I've mischaracterized there, but that's my memory. And then some bugs eat the radioactively injected fruits and vegetables or grains, and then the bugs become huge and attack Chicago.
Bert I. Gordon must have had either a needle phobia or a needle fetish, because there are some fabulous needle scenes in The Amazing Colossal Man as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They bring a huge needle to inject a huge man with.
And then it is a wonderful scene. It's in the trailers and all, where he picks it up and he kind of looks at Glenn Manning, the Amazing Colossal Man, does this, picks this hypodermic needle up, and it's regular size to him. And then he just with expert precision, he just throws it like a dart down at one of these soldiers who just pricked him with it, and it just skewers him. It's a wonderful scene. One of cinema's finest moments. Now, in addition to these examples, you know, you have legions of other mutant humanoids, from telepathic nuke mutants in Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which I'd love to see those guys explored in some of these reboots that are coming out for the Apes movies.
These are the ones that worship a giant bomb.
Yeah.
They like sing hymns to the atomic bomb.
Yeah. They worship the atomic bomb, and they have crazy mental powers. You also have the Chuds from Chud, the cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers.
Uh-huh.
We've mentioned the Ghouls of Fallout. You got the Mutants of Total Recall.
Nice.
Yeah, they were a lot of fun. You have the Mutants of the Hills Have Eyes.
Not so much fun.
Not so fun. Pretty much in any installment of that, they are generally not that fun. But certainly a good B movie example as well. And of course, let's not forget atomic superheroes. That is a huge area of fictional exploration here.
Right. You've got the Hulk. So the official Marvel-approved origin blurb, I looked it up on Marvel.com, for the Hulk reads as follows. Caught in a blast of gamma radiation, brilliant scientist Bruce Banner is cursed to transform in times of stress into the living engine of destruction known as the Incredible Hulk.
Ooh, that's nice.
So, got that straight? Right. The origin story is gamma radiation, then a curse. The curse is that when he gets his briefs in a twist, he changes colors, becomes huge, strong, invincible, rampagey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, this is not, I don't need to tell you, but this is not what happens to a human who's caught in a blast of gamma radiation. We know this in theory and principle, but even if we didn't, we would know it in practice, because this has literally actually happened. I want to talk about one example of a, quote, brilliant scientist caught in a blast of hard radiation, which included gamma rays, among other types of radiation. And that man was Lewis Slotin, a Canadian physicist working at the United States Atomic Testing Facility at Los Alamos, New Mexico, shortly after the conclusion of the Second World War. So on May 21st, 1946, at about 3 PM, Slotin and colleagues were performing a nuclear criticality test on a core of plutonium. And the way a test like this worked is that you would take a mass of fissile material and then bring it almost to the point of going critical by nearly covering it with a beryllium cap. Now, what would that do? Well, the reason a substance like plutonium is dangerous is that the heavy atoms inside it are unstable, and they start to split apart and shoot neutrons off in every direction, releasing a lot of energy in the process. This is nuclear fission. By covering a hemisphere of fissile plutonium with this thick reflective material like beryllium, you reflect those neutrons back into the plutonium, where they hit other atomic nuclei, knock them apart, producing more free neutrons, releasing more energy. And as this happens more and more, you come closer to producing a runaway criticality event. The physicist Richard Feynman, upon hearing this type of experiment described in the 40s, compared it to, quote, tickling the tail of a sleeping dragon.
Mm.
Now, that's because the dragon presumably breathes fire when it wakes up, and about the same is true of a plutonium core. Now, this beryllium cap, called a tamper, It was supposed to be kept from going completely closed, from completely covering the core. As long as there was a gap through which some of the neutrons could still fly out and it wasn't completely covered, the dragon would not fully wake up. But on the day I mentioned earlier, in 1946, while Slotin was performing this experiment, holding the tamper cap open with a screwdriver, an accident happened. His hand slipped, the screwdriver came out of place, and the tamper briefly fell completely over the plutonium mass, causing it to go critical. People in the room described that they saw a flash of blue light, which was the secondary result of the air itself being ionized by a blast of hard radiation. And they also felt this wave of heat wash over them. So their primary radiation exposure lasted really only a split second before Slotin was able to knock the tamper off. He sort of reached out and knocked it away, and he stopped the chain reaction. But he had already, in that tiny split second, received more than enough radiation to kill him. There's a good short New Yorker article about the history of this accident, and it reports that, quote, Slotin's whole body dose was around 2,100 rem of neutrons, gamma rays, and X-rays. 500 rem is usually fatal for humans.
Oh, wow.
So this was an incredibly powerful close-up dose. Right after the exposure, he went outside and vomited, and then the hand closest to the core that he'd been holding right up next to the plutonium turned blue, developed large blisters, and he started experiencing systemic effects that developed for the next 9 days before he died. He was in continuously deteriorating health. His white cell count dropped. His temperature and pulse became erratic. He had digestive distress. According to one medical professional who was trying to explain the nature of his wounds, his internal radiation burns, they described it as, quote, a three-dimensional sunburn.
Oh.
If you can imagine being sunburned on the inside.
Oh, that is rough.
Now, here's a really crazy fact. This was not even the first time this had happened at this lab. Just months before, a Los Alamos worker named Harry Daglian Jr. had been killed by acute radiation exposure in a similar criticality experiment. Not exactly the same. They were using some, like, tungsten carbide bricks, I think. But by the exact same piece of plutonium, which thereafter got its nickname, quote, the Demon Core.
Oh.
And, of course, Slotin is not the only person to suffer death from radiation exposure. You know, victims of the atomic bombing in Japan at the close of World War II tragically suffered many of the same effects. But what's sort of morbidly fascinating about the cases of Slotin and Daglian is that there's no explosion, no fire, there's no conventional physical destruction, just the pure, isolated, almost instantaneous dose of hard radiation that makes every tissue in your body start to fail.
There's almost a magical element to it.
Yeah.
In that, with it being devoid of the explosion and the sort of the traditional attributes of warfare.
Yeah, it does. It does have this kind of magical feel to it because you can't see the mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And it kills you slowly then, because now everything in your body is irreparably damaged, but you can't see exactly what happened. So I think maybe we should take a quick break, and when we come back, we can talk about radiation. We know now, obviously, it doesn't actually make you bigger, stronger, more intelligent, at least for large complex mammals and most other organisms. But if it does kill, how does it kill? Why does it cause this problem?
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro Allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, we're back. So let's take a moment to just really talk about what radiation is. We've been talking about it, and I think most of our listeners have a reasonable working knowledge of radiation, but I think it's a good opportunity to just stop and try and boil it all down here. So it's important to note that our lives are filled with radiation, and much of it is harmless and much of it is natural. Not all radiation is of the apocalyptic variety. Soil and underground gases expose us to radiation, and we're also exposed to cosmic radiation from the sun and outer space. It's mostly all right, mostly fine, if the doses are right, and you're dealing with this natural mode of radiation.
Well, I guess it depends on your definition of fine, but you might say it's unavoidable.
It's just part of
being a creature.
It's unavoidable. And with all radiation, it's going to depend on the type of radiation, the dosage level, and how long you're exposed to it. Because obviously, radiation's coming from the sun. You can get too much sun.
Yeah.
And there are varying definitions of too much sun. There's too much sun over the course of a lifetime. There's too much sun over the course of a day at the beach, right?
But that's a good illustration of the different kinds of risks that are posed by radiation. For example, too much sun at one day at the beach, you risk the sort of the Slotin version, the acute radiation poisoning from the sun, versus too much sun over a lifetime will tend to cause things like skin cancer.
Right, and not enough exposure to the sun can leave you with a vitamin D deficiency. So, there's a balance in all things here. And one of the key aspects we'll get back to too, is that just as radiation is around us, radiation has always been around us.
Right.
Radiation has been there in the background to varying degrees throughout the evolution of life on our planet. So it's not like, oh, it's not like radiation, even though radiation as this theme, as this, this fear and this anxiety really arrived in the 1950s, you know, and we see it echoed in these B movies. Radiation did not arrive on the scene then. Radiation had always been with us. Now, in terms of radiation that stems from human inventions, that's a different area here. So
right.
we're talking about medical procedures, we're talking about televisions, cell phones, microwave ovens. And again, it all depends on dosage, the strength, the type, the length of exposure. Electromagnetic radiation is merely a stream of photons traveling in waves. So we have, you know, low energy photons such as radio waves, and these are just waves. They behave like waves. And while we also have high energy photons such as X-rays, those behave more like particles. So in this, we're getting into this idea of the electromagnetic spectrum,
mm-hmm.
you know, radio, microwaves, infrared, visible light, ultraviolet, X-rays, all the way up to gamma rays.
Yeah, that's an ascending scale of the energy of these photons, and starting somewhere at the upper end of the ultraviolet spectrum. So the upper end of the ultraviolet, the X-rays, the gamma rays, those are the really dangerous, the ionizing types of radiation on the electromagnetic spectrum.
That's right.
So ionizing, that brings up the main distinction we should probably make about the different kinds of radiation, because as we said, we're always surrounded constantly by radiation. It makes a big difference whether that radiation is ionizing or non-ionizing.
Right. And you had that wonderful example earlier about the flash of blue light as the air ionized.
Right. So the radiation that was coming out of that plutonium core was doing something to the atoms in the air. It was making some changes to the structure of the very atoms themselves.
Right. Now, these lower forms of radiation, the non-ionizing variety, they don't have enough energy to ionize atoms or molecules, thus the name. They're located at the low end of the electromagnetic spectrum, and non-ionizing radiation sources in our life include power lines, microwaves, radio waves, infrared radiation, visible light, lasers. Although considered less dangerous than ionizing radiation, overexposure, of course, can cause health issues because, again, it comes down to the degree and the length of exposure.
Right. I mean, it can still – non-ionizing radiation can still, for example, heat tissues, which
right.
can have an effect.
Yeah. But ionizing radiation is energy in the form of particles or waves. And it's so high in energy that it can break chemical bonds, meaning it can change or ionize an atom that interacts with it. At a lower energy, it can strip off a couple of electrons. At higher energy, it can destroy the nucleus of an atom. It can damage DNA. So this is the stuff of radioactive material, very high voltage equipment, nuclear reactions, and stars. And by the way, as long as we're talking about natural versus unnatural radiation, even though there's, you know, sometimes there's you can kind of blur the lines there. On a terrestrial basis, the levels of radiation you would need to cause radiation sickness in really a, you know, acute form pretty much require human technology after a point. So naturally occurring sites of radioactivity, such as, for instance, if you were to travel to Ramsar, Iran.
What, that's like a naturally radioactive site?
Right, yeah. If you were to travel there, you would encounter this, you know, in this radioactive environment, but it wouldn't be enough to produce anything near the high level doses required to inflict the sort of harm we've seen via the detonation of atomic weapons or accidents at nuclear power plants.
Hmm. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, I appreciate that the Earth is like that.
Yeah. And this kind of, I guess, is a nod to this idea of, you know, the atomic age. What is invented in the atomic age? What is unleashed in the atomic age?
Yeah. So while we are naturally surrounded by all kinds of radiation, while we are naturally in a universe of highly radioactive stars and things like that,
mm-hmm.
we're not naturally in a universe of, you know, regular human life scale nuclear reactors and atomic weapons.
Right. It brings some very high radiation events and items into our local environment that generally are not there.
So ionizing radiation, the dangerous kind of radiation, comes in a handful of main varieties. You've basically got high frequency electromagnetic radiation, and then you've got radioactive particles. So let's look at the particles first.
You've got alpha particles and beta particles. Alpha particles are relatively large, and they're made of protons and neutrons.
Right. And because you've got protons without any electrons, what does that mean? It's charged, positive charge. And this means it wants to interact with matter to break bonds and strip away electrons. That's the ionizing part. So what it can do is turn atoms in your body into other differently behaving atoms, charged ions. And alpha particles tend to shoot off of atoms when they undergo radioactive decay.
Now, alpha particles can only travel a short distance. In fact, they can be stopped with just a piece of paper or even your skin. However, inhalation or ingestion of any material that gives off alpha particles, that can be dangerous. Once inside your body, alpha particles can ionize your internal tissue.
And this is what happens in some cases of, like, radioactive poisoning. Somebody's given a poison that contains a radioactive material, and it's putting off alpha particles inside your body. But now what about beta particles?
Oh, beta particles are fast-moving electrons, and they can travel and penetrate far more than alpha particles. Beta particles can be stopped or reduced by a layer of clothing or a substance like aluminum. However, some beta particles have enough energy to penetrate the skin and cause damage that's very similar to burns. As with alpha particles, beta particles are quite hazardous if you inhale or ingest something that releases them.
Right, because yet again, they have a charge, and for this reason, they're going to interact electrically with the tissues inside your body, trying to change stuff around. Now, another type of particle radiation would be neutron radiation. And this just means a free neutron from the nucleus of an atom shooting off all by itself. And this happens during nuclear fission. Neutrons can travel a really long distance, and they can penetrate deeply through many types of objects. And I've read that the best thing for stopping this material is actually something that's rich in hydrogen, for example, water, H2O. This is a good reason water makes a good radiation shield. Neutron radiation is a major part of what actually happened at the Los Alamos criticality accidents. When the Demon Core went supercritical, Lewis Slotin's body was bombarded by neutrons, and this is part of what killed him. But you might be thinking, wait a minute, ionizing radiation, why would neutrons be ionizing radiation? Because if you remember your atomic chemistry, neutrons don't have a charge, positive or negative. So why would they break chemical bonds and change atoms into other things that behave differently? Well, the answer is that neutrons are sort of indirect killers. They themselves don't ionize your tissues, but if a neutron is absorbed into the nucleus of an atom in your body, that atom can now be an unstable isotope. It's got too many neutrons in its nucleus, so the nucleus becomes unstable, meaning it could now undergo fission and emit radiation. So neutron radiation has the power to turn normal, safe materials into radioactive materials, which in turn would then emit ionizing radiation and harm you. But I guess we should now, let's look at the pure energy radiation, like gamma rays.
Yeah, gamma rays are a type of electromagnetic radiation. Gamma rays often accompany alpha and beta particles. Unlike alpha and beta particles, however, they're extremely penetrating. In fact, several inches of lead or even a few feet of concrete are necessary to stop gamma rays. They're a radiation hazard for the entire body, meaning that although they'll pass through you, your tissue is going to absorb some rays.
Yeah, and then also, of course, there are X-rays, lower energy than gamma rays, but still ionizing and potentially very dangerous depending on the dose. Basically, the way that X-rays and gamma rays hurt you is by introducing huge amounts of energy into the atoms in your body, which, again, breaks molecular bonds, strips electrons away from atoms, creating free charged particles that want to interact with other atoms and molecules to change them. Now, of course, in a lot of cases where you're getting a dose of hard radiation, it's not going to be just one of these things or another. You're getting a mixture of different types of radiation all coming at you simultaneously.
So overexposure to ionizing radiation can cause mutations in your genes. This can cause birth defects, raise risk of cancer, and then you'll get burns, radiation sickness, etc. But in order to kill you, it would just need to damage or kill enough cells to cause a more immediate or immediate death, or just to cause cancer.
Yeah, so for a really rough analogy, imagine a huge machine like a aircraft carrier or battleship that is bombarded by millions of invisible tiny pinpricks. And each of these pinpricks has a certain random chance of hitting a component within that ship and then changing it into something else, like maybe a screw turns into a nut or a copper wire into a piece of foam. A ship might be able to survive a certain number of these magic pinpricks and still run, but at a certain level of exposure, you're basically guaranteed to make enough changes to the ship that it no longer functions as a machine and maybe even sinks when the hull itself fails. Now, one thing to notice is that the harmful effects of radiation are based on atomic physics and chemistry. Any complex system that's made out of atoms should be somewhat vulnerable to radiation. And for this reason, it really should affect any organism, right? It shouldn't be just humans or something. All organisms are made out of atoms and molecules. No organism wants to have its atoms and molecules broken up, changed into different atoms and molecules. Like, no, I need that. So the molecular structures in our bodies are the way they are for a reason that has to do with survival.
Right. But where it gets interesting is, again, for the probably fifth time, it comes down to the dosage level and the exposure length.
Right.
And also varying species, varying organisms are going to have different levels of resistance to radiation as well.
Exactly. So this is a concept in biology of radioresistance. Mm-hmm. Not all organisms are equally susceptible to radiation. Some are able to withstand more than others. And as we'll get into in a bit, some might even go, go across the line to the other side of the ledger. And not just resist, but benefit.
Indeed. All right. So on that note, shall we go to Chernobyl? I think we should probably travel.
Let's take
to
a trip.
Okay.
To scenic Ukraine.
So Chernobyl is one of those, it's one of those places, one of those events where the name continues to resonate. And, you know, listeners out there are going to have varying degrees of familiarity with Chernobyl, but I thought it would be helpful just to very quickly run through where Chernobyl is and what occurred.
And now we should keep in mind that I think in the future we might want to do a whole episode on the science of the Chernobyl disaster and its many downstream effects through time, because there have been a lot of studies about not just what happened at this nuclear meltdown, but what happened in the decades since.
Right. I mean, even the story of how it occurred is fascinating as well.
Yeah. So tell me about it, Robert.
All right. So when it comes to environmental disasters, the 1986 Chernobyl catastrophe is often kind of at the top of the list, or it certainly has some of the, it has the name value that you don't find with a lot of other environmental disasters. So this was this explosion spewed 50 tons of radioactive material into the air, and the reactor burned for 10 days, forcing the evacuation of at least 30,000 people from the Ukrainian town of Pripyat. In the decades to follow, we've had continuous study pretty much of how this affected not only the local environment, but the broader environment.
Now, when people hear meltdown in the United States, a lot of them might have the U.S. point of Three Mile Island. You know, they know something happened there, but mm-hmm. it's not comparable.
Right. So 1979's Three Mile Island incident, that was a partial nuclear meltdown. Chernobyl was a total meltdown. So Russian teams chased the melted remnants of the plant's reactor core into the facility's basement. They flooded it with water to cool off the materials, keep them from burning down, to try and stop it before it could burn through the containment building and pollute the groundwater.
Hmm.
Next, they dumped boron, clay, dolomite, lead, and sand onto the burning core by helicopter to put out the fires and limit the radioactive particles that were now rising up into the atmosphere. And in the months that followed, they encased the ruined plant in a concrete shielding that's often referred to as the sarcophagus.
Yeah.
Which puts, you know, a suitably dark, darker note on everything here. But of course, the damage was already done by that point. Subsequent inquiries would reveal just what the damage amounted to. As far as humans were concerned, the World Health Organization puts the fatality estimates at 4,000 deaths. This is a quote from World Health Organization. They said, this includes some 50 emergency workers who died of acute radiation syndrome and 9 children who died of thyroid cancer, and an estimated total of 3,940 deaths from radiation-induced cancer and leukemia among the 200,000 emergency workers from 1986 to 1987, 116,000 evacuees, and 270,000 residents of the most contaminated areas. Total about 600,000. So food contaminated with radioactive iodine was a major factor, especially with children. Radioactive iodine ended up in the milk from cows who ate contaminated grasses.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And then the environmental impact overall, this was a major release of radionuclides that continued for 10 days and contaminated more than 200,000 square kilometers or 77,220 square miles of Europe. Most of the strontium and plutonium isotopes were deposited within 100 kilometers or 62 miles of the damaged reactor. So the radioactive iodine luckily had a short half-life, and that's all gone now. Mm-hmm. The strontium and the cesium has a longer half-life of about 30 years, so that's going to remain an issue for decades. But then this quote comes to us from World Health again. They said, although plutonium isotopes in americium-241 will persist perhaps for thousands of years, their contribution to human exposure is low.
This shows the kind of crazy way that radioactive material can behave, almost kind of like a plague spreading throughout. Mm-hmm. Except it's not like a plague, because generally a plague is more contained to certain types of organisms,
you know, right.
It'll target rats or birds or humans or something like that. This is almost like a, you know, material plague that spreads all throughout the ecosystem. And because of the way that different organisms in the ecosystem absorb materials, trap them, and then get consumed and decompose and redistribute them, it just kind of goes everywhere.
Now, one quick note on the idea of giant mutants. Now, obviously, no giant animals came rampaging out of the forests surrounding Chernobyl.
Not even giant Ukrainian crabs.
No giant Ukrainian crabs. The U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Human Radiation Experiments, they're very quick to remind us that genetic mutations due to radiation, they do not produce the visible monstrosities of science fiction. You know, it just produces a greater frequency of the same mutations that occur continuously and spontaneously in nature. So the natural world does not produce radioactive giants, at least in the animal kingdom, because the realm of plants is interesting as another matter entirely. In the wake of Chernobyl and other radioactive accidents, we have seen various malformations, including dwarfism, strange growths, glowing, and yes, even gigantism, especially concerning pine needles.
Wow.
So that's
pine
one.
Pine needles.
Yeah. So that's one of the few areas where we can say, yes, we have seen atomic gigantism. Pine needles. But who's going to watch Attack of the Pine Needles, right?
I would. Dude, you think predatory animals are ruthless? Imagine predatory atomic plants.
Plants
have no compassion whatsoever. They don't even process the concept of cuteness. A giant lion might want to kill you, but at least it recognizes that large eyes are cute. The pine tree does not.
All right, well, maybe there's some potential there.
You know, I would say, though, if I was going to get killed by a killer pine tree, I would hope it was a Jeffrey pine.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, the best kind of pine.
Well, it has a friendly name, yeah.
So despite what organisms you might see like this surviving, resisting in environments contaminated with radiation and radioactive particles, whether or not they've got apparent mutations, you would still expect that ionizing radiation is always a net negative influence on an organism, right? Except in those rare cases maybe where it causes a freak mutation that provides a survival advantage. So those are going to be the minority, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some radio-resistant or just plain lucky organisms might survive despite the hardship of ambient radiation. But what if there were organisms like the Hulk or like the crab monsters that seem to actively benefit from the universal high-energy death magic of ionizing radiation? We are going to answer that question when we get back from this break.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
All right, we're back.
All right, so we've talked about ionizing, non-ionizing radiation. Well, ionizing radiation has always been a part of the terrestrial environment.
Right, comes from space.
Yeah, and early life forms here on Earth had to have considerable resistance to it in order to survive and to advance into other forms.
Oh, yeah, I should mention radioactive rocks as well.
Oh, yeah.
Exist on Earth.
So background radiation levels are much lower now than they were on the early Earth. But terrestrial life still exists in a field of radiation. Fungi in particular show a strong resistance. So you see this stuff thriving aboard space stations, adapting to extreme conditions. We've covered this on the show before, and I imagine everyone out there has run across constant articles about the extremophile organisms in our world and how they force us to re-examine what life is and where life can thrive.
There's a reason there are limits to how long you can spend on the International Space Station.
Mm-hmm.
If you go up there, they won't let you stay forever. You need to come back. And that's for your own good.
Right.
There are multiple reasons. I mean, some of them might have to do with like the long-term effects of microgravity on the human body, which we don't fully understand yet. But a lot of it is clearly due to the known risks from exposure to ionizing radiation while you're up there outside the Earth's atmosphere. There are elevated levels of radiation in space, and you shouldn't get too much of this or it's going to hurt you. Now, as you say, there are these microorganisms, these fungal microbes mm-hmm. that survive up there in the ISS for generations, apparently, in space, and they seem to be doing just fine.
Yeah. So,
and it's true. You mentioned the radio resistance of fungi. I think generally fungi are considered the most radio resistant, kingdom of life.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not wrong about that. I think that's generally correct.
Yeah. We're up there in space, you know, sort of barely managing. Then we come back with the fungi. They're saying, get me on that generation ship. I'm ready to go.
Right.
Let's see some new worlds.
Well, they might need to be on the generation ship if we need something to eat while we're going out there, but we'll get to that in a minute. So we're going to talk about a study by several authors, one of whom is the distinguished microbiologist and immunologist Arturo Casadevall. And he tells this story about how years ago he was reading about how robotic exploration of the Chernobyl ruins, that from the Chernobyl disaster we were just talking about, the total meltdown of the power plant. So there's robotic exploration of these ruins, and they revealed that something was growing on the walls of the abandoned reactor, some sort of mat of dark fungus. But this is definitely weird because this was a dangerously radioactive environment. You know, the pinpricks of ionizing radiation are going all over the place all the time. It'd be kind of like if you just let the demon core go critical for a while and discovered that a bunch of squirrels began nesting in the test shack. You'd want to know, what's the deal with those squirrels?
Yeah, and please stay away from those squirrels.
Yeah. Not as bad as the pine needles, but they might be worse than the crabs. So one of the first things to notice about this fungus that's growing in the presence of radiation is that it's specifically dark fungus. This is an indication of the presence of the pigment melanin. Now, melanin is a natural polymer pigment. It's found in all kinds of organisms. In humans, varieties of melanin are produced by special cells known as melanocytes. And the melanin itself is responsible for providing the pigmentation of body parts like your irises, your hair, and your skin. And of course, there are a couple different kinds of melanin. There are several kinds, actually. Like, there is the eumelanin. This is the common kind that's black or brown in color. So if your hair is dark, if you have black or brown hair, it probably has a lot of eumelanin in it. There's also pheomelanin. This is usually what's seen in like the hair of people who have red hair or maybe light brown, reddish hair. And in the skin, melanin is believed to play a role in the natural human relationship to radiation because scientists think that it protects our cells, especially our DNA, from damage by an everyday form of ionizing or near ionizing radiation, which is the ultraviolet or UV radiation found in sunlight. So naturally, dark objects tend to absorb more light. This is, in fact, by definition, what makes objects dark.
Mm-hmm.
So black or brown melanin has properties of absorbing electromagnetic radiation, including UV radiation, and dissipating it by converting it into heat. In this way, it is thought to be able to protect the nuclei of your skin cells from being constantly bombarded, damaged, and mutated by the invisible death rays of the sun. And the pigment absorbs the radiation so your genetic material doesn't have to. So melanin, in that way, is a natural shield against radiation. It's one of the ways that organisms have evolved natural radio resistance, and even our own bodies make use of it. But the role of melanin doesn't stop there. There's some evidence that melanin may play other roles in the human body and in other organisms. For example, the fungal microbe Cryptococcus neoformans.
Oh, yeah, that's your DJ name.
Yeah, DJ Cryptococcus neoformans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'll have to be able to say that really fast over a beat.
Yeah, you need to be able to say in the house at the end of it. They need to know that not only are you here, but you are in the house. And if you were playing house music, you need to be able to tell everyone that that is what they're listening to.
I'm not in the house. I'm in the abandoned reactor room.
I'm just telling you the rules, Joe.
So Cryptococcus neoformans is a fungus that's found everywhere, just pretty much everywhere in nature. It's also potentially pathogenic, causing diseases in people, especially with impaired immune function. For example, it often causes lung infections in people who have AIDS. So for some reason, it has been observed that melanin production in this fungal germ is associated with virulence, More melanin production means a more powerful germ, and it's been suggested that this is because melanin helps the fungus protect itself against the host's immune response. Hmm. So we're seeing that melanin may have a diverse role, essentially, in different life functions and for all different kinds of organisms. I mean, this is weird to remember. We're talking about a fungus here, but this is also a pigment that animals share. It's in all the kingdoms of life, which tends to be an indicator that it's probably quite ancient in origin, that melanin goes way back. Now, Robert, you mentioned earlier that in previous geological eras, in, you know, past life on Earth was exposed to a lot more ionizing radiation than we are on the surface of the Earth now. And if you look at the role of melanin as a very ancient thing emerging very early in life on Earth, that may sort of provide an explanation, right? If there was a lot of radiation back then and melanin has this role in protecting organisms from radiation, you can see one reason it might have emerged. Now, let's go back to the paper I mentioned earlier. So as we saw hinted in the blasted concrete dungeon of the Chernobyl reactor room, this dark pigment in some types of fungus plays an even weirder, more fascinating role. Not just protecting organisms from harmful radiation, but allowing them to thrive on it.
Yeah, this paper, this was a 2007 paper published in PLOS1, titled Ionizing Radiation Changes the Electronic Properties of Melanin and Enhances the Growth of Melanized Fungi.
Right, and that was by a long list of authors, Dadakova, Brian, Huang, Modell, Schweitzer, Eisen, Nozenchuk, and Cassidyval.
Yeah, and they found some interesting evidence that the fungi containing the pigment melanin can utilize the ionizing radiation portion of the electromagnetic spectrum to transform radioactive energy into biological energy. And this would be in keeping, crazy enough, with the way that chlorophyll in plants converts sunlight into bioenergy.
That is crazy. Now, yeah. If that's correct, it would be absolutely bizarre and fascinating that essentially a cosmic dark kind of parody of, mm-hmm. Oh, I shouldn't say parody. I don't mean to demean it. A fascinating, weird parallel of photosynthesis, the kind of photosynthesis we see in plants and blue-green algae and things, is going on with mushrooms. But instead of regular sunlight, they're using gamma radiation, this high energy stuff that should kill any organism. So, if this is correct, how did they determine it? Like, how did they determine that the fungi were not only surviving in the presence of this, but were actively benefiting from it? So here's the basic experiment, or this part of the experiment. There were multiple experiments in this study. The basic experiment on the fungus was that two species of fungus contained melanin, the Cryptococcus neoformans and the Wangeola dermatitis. It's got a lot of dental consonants in it. Both were placed in environments with strong ionizing radiation, more than 500 times what you'd get from standard background radiation on Earth. And then these melanized cells in radioactive conditions were found to have had, quote, higher CFUs, more dry weight biomass, and threefold greater incorporation of C14 acetate than non-irradiated melanized cells or irradiated albino mutants. Now that's a mouthful. What did that mean? In other words, by several measures, the melanin fungus exposed to strong radiation was more biologically successful. It grew more. It did better than fungus that was not irradiated, or fungus that was irradiated but didn't have significant melanin in its cells. So put a pale fungus in radiation, nah, doesn't like it. Put have a regular non-irradiated fungus, you know, it does its thing. But you put one of these dark pigmented funguses or fungi under radiation and it thrives. It loves it.
It's a power up to it. It's food to it in a sense.
That's what appears to be happening. Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't fully confirmed, but that's what they think they observed here. And to further bolster this idea, they tried to uncover leads as to what the mechanism might be, right? So if you find something in nature that looks very odd, one of the ways that you can really help build your case that it is that what you're seeing is really what you think it is to find out how it works, right? So they tried to uncover a possible mechanism, and the mechanism of how ionizing radiation might be converted into usable energy went like this. They found through experiment that exposure to ionizing radiation increased the electron transfer properties of melanin. Again, what does that mean? Well, essentially it changed the electronic capabilities of this pigment. The best way I've seen it put into simple, understandable terms is from a 2007 article in Scientific American by David Biello, who claimed that the melanin in this case, quote, acts like a step-down electric transformer. Transformers you might see, you know, turning the electricity from the power grid into something that you can use in your house.
Yeah, taking something that would normally just fry the bejesus out of everything you hold dear into something that is tame enough, domesticating the current for you.
Right. So what the pigment does under this model is it's hit with incredibly high energy radiation that should destroy life. Instead, the pigment absorbs it through some electrical transfer. It manages to tone it down a bit into some kind of energy that can be used by the organism to sustain its life function.
So some of the far-reaching effects of this study are pretty fascinating. The researchers suggest that radiation-grown fungi might one day feed human space travelers on
That's
lengthy
great.
Missions.
Yeah, because out in space, you're exposed to a lot of ionizing radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're, say, far from sunlight, and you don't want to have to use your own power on grow lamps to grow plants in your spaceship, what do you have to work with out in deep space? Well, if you could actually grow something on ionizing radiation that you could eat, that would be amazing.
And what if it glowed as well? You have like glowing fungal spheres that are lighting your environment. So you can really go wild with some of the possibilities here. But they also speculate that this could even unlock the possibility that this is just a possibility, that this is not proven, that melanin in human flesh might provide energy to skin cells.
Now, that, like you say, it's just a speculation. It would be consistent with their findings, but it's not something that's proven, but really interesting.
Yeah.
If that were true, it would also provide an interesting twist on this old claim. I know you've heard, Robert, the idea of the sun eaters.
Oh, yes.
The people who it's basically a supernatural claim, but these people claim that some monks and holy people can live for years without eating food, getting all of the nourishment and energy their body needs just straight from the sunlight. Now, obviously, I don't think that even if this were true, that we were getting usable bioenergy through the melanin in our skin cells, I don't think it would make those claims plausible. I think that's still pretty much nonsense. But it'd be a cool twist on it, because even if you could get some tiny amount of usable bioenergy from the sunlight, it wouldn't come close to the amount of concentrated chemical energy you get from eating food, right?
Right.
You know, for a rough analogy, think about the electromagnetic energy harvested from solar panels versus the dense chemical energy contained in gasoline.
Right. It does make me think back to our episode on Chinese immortality, where we talked about the idea of these aged individuals living just on dew and the wind.
Right.
It would kind of fall in line with that vision of this ephemeral life form that's just barely subsisting on the things around it.
Hmm. Well, I mean, it just makes me wonder, if this were the case, that you get some usable bioenergy through your skin cells, what I would want to see is the thought experiment that explains, okay, given how that works, what would the naked surface area of your body need to be in order to replace certain amounts of food? Like, could you live on 500 calories a day if you had X amount of naked surface area and sat out in the sun all day?
Like if you had like a large skin flap, like a Dimitrodon.
Yeah, exactly.
Something of that nature.
Basically a human solar panel.
Like yeah.
If you had giant wings to stretch out and absorb all the light. But then you'd also be losing a lot of heat energy, I would guess, but I don't know.
I do love the idea of it. The big thing is that this study does force us to reevaluate life and how life not only interacts now, but has just evolved in the presence of radiation.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird how the stuff that seems so normal to us on Earth is maybe not normal. In fact, it's just a circumstantial byproduct of what Earth is like.
Mm-hmm.
And that life on another planet, the same kind of biology, the same kind of relationship with energy in the universe that seems so intuitive to us might be very weird to them. I mean, what if there's a planet that really thrives on gamma radiation? I'm not sure if that's plausible. That might not make sense, but, you know, I could imagine it. You know, what if they're really just confused by the idea of a whole food ecosystem that's built off the energy from sunlight, which is where everything on Earth comes from.
Yeah, yeah. This is something that came up in the episode that did recently with Christian on butter. Mm-hmm. Like you really break down butter. Butter comes from the sun.
Everything comes from the sun. It's all solar.
Yeah. I mean, your steak comes from the sun. Your whatever, your milkshake comes from the sun. And all of it is essentially solar energy that has been transformed into something else, something that you can consume. You're just gobbling it up further down the food chain.
Right. All right. We got to end with crazy ideas. I've got one. Here's one. Hazmat suits made entirely out of mold.
I like it. Yeah.
Get like a black fungus bodysuit to cover you up and protect you when you wade into the nuclear waters.
Especially if it grows rapidly. So it's essentially it's kind of like a glow stick. You just break this in half and two fluid chambers converge. And then this black mold just grows all over you.
Yeah. And it's because it's alive, it's self-healing. So instead of your hazmat suit getting punctured and now you're like, oh, well, I'm ruined now. Instead it would grow back, seal itself up.
Huh.
That wouldn't really work, would it?
No, maybe not. But you know, it makes me think about the various theories that have been thrown out over the years about the future of the human species in space. The basic cyborg idea that human and must become more machine, that there must be this synthesis of biology and technology in order to make this adaptation possible. What if the future is Homo sapiens becoming a symbiotic, more of a symbiotic organism, and bringing in this fungal existence?
That's
what if the
cool.
space, you know, this idea of the living suit? What if that is the future of the human race?
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes to the idea of when we think of the cyborg, it's humans joining with human-made artificial technology that's, you know, made of metal and plastic and, you know, molded pieces. I like the idea of the bio-cyborg, the hybrid organism.
Yeah, especially if we end up with a big mushroom cap head, then, you know, it's all worth it.
Will become space lichens.
Yeah, space lichens. Invasion of the Space Lichens. There's the next movie I'd like to see, along with The Killer Pine Trees and some of the other hypothetical B movies we've discussed in this episode.
Have I told you about the B movie that I've recently been thinking we've got to write and produce?
What's this? Is this the Hellraiser inspired?
No. Okay. It's called Planet of the Satans.
Of the Satans?
Of the Satans.
All Satans?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you got Planet of the Vampires, but you got to go a step up. Planet of the Satans.
That would be good. Yeah, or a Planet of the Frankensteins. I would like that as well.
Uh-huh.
But, Planet of the Satans. It would be kind of like everyone on the planet is a Satan. And then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, not the people who arrive there.
Uh-huh.
They've got to deal with the native Satans.
Ooh, what if you do a Santa Claus versus the Martians kind of thing, where you have a world where there is no Satan, and they said the children need Satan. Without Satan, how are they to live their lives? And then they decide, well, we're going to go and we're going to steal a Satan from the planet of the Satans, and then that will be our world, Satan, and that'll put everything in balance. And then that's the origin story for life on Earth. Big spoiler at the end. Yeah. The fall of man. All right.
You did it, Robert. You lived up to the name.
Yeah, that's how we do it. All right. So, hey, if you want more on this topic and other topics, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where we have all the podcast episodes, videos, blog posts, links out to various social media accounts such as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. We'll also include links to related material on the landing page for this episode.
And if you want to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, or you want to let us know about a topic you'd like us us to do in the future, or just to say hi, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.